Yeah, so I think I was drawn to coffee because of community first. Later, as I learned more about coffee and I tasted better coffees, I grew to appreciate coffee, you know, on its own.
Hello and welcome to the Small and Local Podcast, where I tell you the stories of small businesses. We all know how important small business owners are to the economy of the United States. They make up over 40% of the United States' yearly GDP. But when you look at these businesses through a purely economic view, you miss the most important detail. All these businesses are run by people, everyday folks like you and I. I'm Jay, and I want to show you the people and places who keep this country running, one day at a time. This episode of The Small Local is from Roast to Host, and will focus on Into Coffee, a small coffee shop out of Columbia, South Carolina. Beautiful. Adjective. Definition. Pleasing to the senses or mind aesthetically, or of very high standard. In Indonesian, one of the possible ways to say beautiful is Inda. Inda Coffee Co. is just as the name implies, a beautiful coffee shop located in the historic Cottontown district of North Columbia. Owned and operated by husband and wife duo, Nick and Stephanie Hooser, Inda Coffee has been operating since 2010, with its first brick-and-mortar location opening in 2017. Every business has a story, and I'm here to show you Inda's. I asked Nick Hooser what got him into coffee, because you can't have a business without its owner.
I spent a season in Southeast Asia, and so it was during that time I couldn't find like good coffee to drink. Most of the cafes most of the grocery stores and stuff like that had like almost like Nescafe, just powdered sugar powder that you stirred into hot water, and that's what they called coffee. And I didn't want like a freeze dried product. I wanted real coffee. So I started asking the locals, where can I get real kopi? Malaysia and Indonesia, that's how they say kopi with a K-O-B-I. And like when I would ask for kopi, they would hold up the little packets. And I was like, I don't want that. Like everything else about Southeast Asian culture is farm to table. They don't call it that. That's just what they do. You know, if it's a stir fry, I mean, they're right there dicing up the vegetables and the produce, and you know, just everything is like super fresh. You know, if there's meat, it's right off the docks. If it's seafood, and if it's chicken, it was processed that morning. So you know, you're eating super fresh food that's not been frozen. But then when it was coffee, it was a disconnect. So I would get, you know, I was getting this product that was like packed, co-packed in a warehouse, you know, like in a facility in Europe. And I was like, this is weird. And I knew that coffee was grown in the area. We were, a short plane ride from Sumatra. And so finally, one of my local friends owned a restaurant. He said, hey, if you want coffee, I've got a friend coming in from, you know, Sumatra. He works for coffee farmers down in Sumatra. He was actually a veterinarian, so he worked with coffee farmers in that, like when their animals were sick or they were doing well checks, he was just going out and visiting them. And so he was also trying to help them find markets for the coffee. So I was like, that'd be great. Bring me some coffee. And so he showed up with a paper sack of green coffee seeds. And at the time, I mean, this is a lot of years ago, I had, you know, as an American, I had really hadn't ever interacted with raw coffee before. I was familiar with the roasted coffee, but not the unroasted coffee seed. And so when I got there, I was like, all right, well, so this is coffee. What do I do with it? And that led to getting out a wok and roasting coffee in a wok over on a Bunsen burner. Furthermore, I kind of was fascinated by the process. And he invited me. He said, you know, if you want to learn more, why don't you come down and stay with me in Sumatra? And and go out and I'll introduce you to some farmers, that kind of thing. So I started going. So I bought a ticket the next day, flew down to Sumatra, started traveling around from farm to farm and learning more about the processing and the, you know, the agriculture part of it, you know, and just realizing, wow, this is way more complex than I ever dreamed.
It's Jay again. I hope you've been enjoying this episode of The Small Local. I want to pop in and tell you some extra info to help those who aren't from Colombia to understand the latter half of this story. I want to talk a little bit about the Market on Main. The Market on Main, or Soda City as the locals call it, is a weekly event held on Saturday mornings in front of the State Capitol building on Main Street. It's a place for people to gather and see what Colombia has to offer. Every Saturday, Main Street fills with people and businesses showing off their wares, whether that be food, vintage clothes, balloon animals, or custom furniture. Soda City has something to offer everyone. And in the case of Inda, it was the starting point of what would become a staple in Colombia.
So the all-local market, we actually started going to the all-local market in 2010.
The name Soda City is anonymous with the Market on Main as it is today. But, you know, that started in 2005 with the six small shops in front of the, it was the Gervain Wine.
And then it was over at Rosewood Market. It was in a couple of different places. It was kind of a nomadic market for a little bit. Emil DeFelice, who to this day is still, you know, kind of the founder of Soda City Market, he was the guy that started that. And he was farming as well.
Where was the market located when you started out?
It was at 701 Whaley. And so we met there every Saturday. And then even for a while, we were doing a Wednesday night market as well. And Main Street in Colombia was a ghost town on the weekends. Like, I mean, literally, you go on Main Street and you might see two or three people in an hour on a Saturday morning. Like, literally, I've sat on a bench and counted. True story. And, I mean, even in like 2011, 2012. Because I was actually trying to consider whether a coffee shop on Main Street would be sustainable. So I sat down there and counted people walking down the sidewalk, sat on a bench.
Now times have changed. Things have become different. It's been because the market moved from 701 Whaley in October of 2012 to Main Street. And then it stayed the all-local farmers market for about 3 years until it was properly renamed to Soda City. In 2015.
Yeah, and that was it might have been 2014. I don't remember the exact. You can look at their website for the exact timeline. I want to say
it is 2015.
Okay, gotcha.
That always comes up whenever.
If that's what, you know, I'll take your word for it. But we had basically been at 701 Whaley for that time, and then it moved to Main Street.
So, when you started on 701 Whaley before, you know, the operation moved to Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
What was your setup like? Did you have like a tent or?
We actually had that metal cart right there behind you. And I had a coffee brewer on it. I had a tank of water underneath and we would basically like brew the coffee there. And then we had a little tabletop roaster and I would roast on site.
Is this the little red roaster that you have listed on your website?
Yeah.
Do you still have that or did you get rid of that?
No, a friend of mine has it now, but yes, he roasts at home.
Did you exclusively roast or did you roast and make coffee?
We started roasting and then we would show up with our coffee and people would be like, well, I'd like to try it. Do you have something to taste? And it was kind of very quickly like, oh yeah, we need to be able to sample this because, I mean, people are going to buy it. They want to see how it tastes first. And so we bootstrapped. We started the business with not enough money to start a business. I'll just leave it at that. And every penny that we, of, you know, money, that every time we sold coffee, we just put everything back into it. And it took us a while to just even get enough to where we could buy coffee equipment to brew and that kind of thing. And we bought a lot of used equipment and that kind of thing. So it kind of took us a while, but I was enjoying it. I loved the community of the market. I loved how coffee was bringing people together. I enjoyed the conversations about I mean, you know, like it was something I was excited about, passionate about. And then I tended to like start meeting other people who had interest in it as well.
What did you do before?
So, I mean, I've worked in millwork and sales. So, I mean, I used to sell windows, doors, package trim, stair parts, stuff like that for a company out of North Carolina, had a territory in South Carolina. That's what brought me to Columbia. I have worked in, I've worked at universities, like in the development office, some restaurant experience as well, that kind of thing, and sales, so stuff like that. And then basically, I guess the other thing before, we didn't have this spot at the time, so.
You opened the brick and mortar store in 2017?
And so before we had this, I had a detached garage behind our old house. And it was just an old center block building. And I was basically like a large tool shed kind of thing. Like a 20 by 40 building kind of thing. And so we started having people say, you know, like, I like this coffee, you know. Can we get this to a restaurant, that kind of thing? And we needed a kitchen to properly produce it for other people, you know. And so we converted our detached garage into a roastery. So that was the original roastery, was kind of behind our house. And so then I would, you know, come home from work and, you know, we'd have dinner, tuck the kids in, and then I'd go out and roast coffee at night and then deliver it on the way into work the next day, that kind of thing. And we did that for several years. And kind of during that time, the all local market, you know, Emil had this idea, and I think Mayor Benjamin was also kind of, you know, talking with him and had something to do with it as well, trying to figure out how to revitalize Main Street. And decided, hey, what if we brought this market down to Main Street instead of 701 Whaley? It's got a pretty good crowd now. It's kind of growing out of this space. And I know there was a lot of pushback on, like, there's not even enough vendors if everybody shows up to fill up half a city block. Why would we do it down there? It's such a big space. It'll just feel empty. And I remember for the first year, I mean, there were people that got mad and left because they didn't want, and they kind of protested. And even some people are like, well, fine, we'll just keep doing a market at either 701 or somewhere else. Emil coined that phrase, Soda City, you know, to kind of the play on cola.
So they were the one that coined the term, or was that just like a general phrase that was used?
I think Emil was the first one to popularize it. There were probably some people that just, you know, like, oh yeah, Soda City.
I mean, that phrase itself, like, not to get deep into it, but we've seen it become so popularized by the market on Main, for example. That's the big one. But then we have like the Soda Pop bus.
There's Soda City Movers. There's Soda City Landscape. There's Soda City. I mean, there's all kinds of things. So, but yeah, Emil and Soda City were that was really where it became popularized. I don't know if they were the one that first spoke the words or whatever, but yeah, I would say it's pretty widely attributed that they were that's where it kind of, and we were in that initial core of maybe 10 vendors that came down to Main Street and were there like 52 Saturdays a year, set up rain or shine. And sometimes I get out there, and I remember one time it was 17 degrees outside and my coffee brewer literally froze up and the copper pipe busted because it was so cold that the water in the line froze and just cracked the copper pipe on it. I mean, I remember some like crazy Saturdays. But that was something that, you know, Emil really pushed from the start. He was like, look, we want our customers to be loyal. They show up, so we need to show up rain or shine and be here, that kind of thing. So that's kind of how so it was so you kind of like, all right, yeah, sometimes the weather was bad and you knew it was going to be a bad day, and it was gonna, but anyway, over the years, yeah, it's really been amazing to see like the transformation of even Main Street went from being like all abandoned buildings. On the weekends, it was a complete ghost town. It went from that to being vibrant and lively. And I rode my bike down to the market a few weeks ago, and I couldn't get on the street with the bike. I couldn't ride my bike through. I mean, it was like from the sidewalks, the street, like the whole thing was just shoulder to shoulder with people. And like you couldn't get, there wasn't room to ride a bike through it. You know, it was that thick with people. And I was like, this is amazing. You know, like who would have, it's way beyond what I ever fathomed. And not only did it fill up a whole city block, it filled up 5 city blocks like that. That's from 2015 to after about 3 years, after 2 years, it really started just jamming. And then it's kind of like kept creeping out to another block.
So did it only start out as the one block in front of the Capitol building, or was it one of
those
further?
It started on the, it was usually either on the 13 or 1400 block. I'd say 1400 is probably generally the center block.
And then it crept closer to the Capitol building is what you're saying.
Yeah, and it morphs. Sometimes seasonally, you know, like obviously even now, like there's seasons. When it gets into the really cold, like in January, February, the market will shrink back down to like 2 or 3 blocks. And then in the, you know, like in the spring and fall in peak, I mean, it goes to like 5 blocks, that kind of thing. And then sometimes there's an adjacent festival tacked on another block past that, you know, so it can be really crazy. I'd say 2013, 2014, I remember sitting on the sidewalk on the 1300 block and watching and counting customers. I mean, it was literally, I wanted to see like how many people actually would come down here on the weekend. And there would be maybe 2 or 3 people per hour walking down the sidewalk in a whole hour. So like to where it's like there's 3,000 people every 5 minutes walking down the sidewalk now, you know, I mean, it's such a transformation. And then, you know, of course, it kind of paved the way for a lot of other things. You know, you start, then the Mass General Store comes in, gives an anchor retailer, start getting some like cool restaurants and, you know, other things down there as well. And and also when we first started Soda City, like the criticism was there's not even enough vendors if they all showed up on a Saturday to fill half a city block. Why'd we do it here? Well, now, obviously, there's enough vendors to fill 5 city blocks, and then they're turning people away sometimes. But yeah, Soda City has been instrumental in transforming the landscape of downtown Columbia, like Main Street specifically. But it's really given an anchor to the weekend there.
Do you think Soda City has revitalized Columbia? Or do you think it's just like a small part of what's going to be happening? Because,
you know, I would say that Main Street is probably 3 or 4 years ahead of where it would have been had there not been a Soda City in progression. I mean, it was a spark to bring life to that. I think had that not, it would have drug on. I mean, there's a general trend, you know, I've seen revitalization of other cities. Downtown Greenville, I remember back in the late 90s, there was one coffee shop, Coffee Underground, and there was a couple of restaurants down there. And the West End was completely, like, it was just all abandoned buildings and everything. And I mean, like, it was, downtown Greenville was a place that, like, you know, after about 8:30 at night, it's not necessarily somewhere you want to like hang out. Now it's, you know, consider one of the, you know, best downtowns in the country. And but that didn't happen overnight. But it took some some foresight. They changed. They had that waterfall running right through downtown. And they changed, there was an overpass running right over the waterfall, covering up this beautiful natural resource. And they kind of rerouted that, kind of reworked it, and then built this huge, beautiful park.
So let's get off Soda City for a moment, but we're still going to be on it technically. So when did you decide that you had enough that you were able to go from having a tent with, a few machines to deciding, I want a brick and mortar store. When did that process show? Because you said that you were thinking about opening a place on Main, but then you saw two people an hour and you were just like, I don't think that's a good idea.
So I would say from late 2010 to 2014, 2015 range, we were in the realm of like hobby business.
So you always had the idea, but you never had the resource to be able to.
I have six kids. Mm-hmm. And like at the time, the idea of starting a business was pretty frightening because I was like, all right, even if this is a good idea, even if it makes money, I don't know, I can't feed my family with this immediately, and that kind of thing. And so, a lot of people maybe like in college they were a barista, and then they kind of, worked up, kind of learned more about the business, and then decided, at some point, this is what I want to do. I love coffee. I want to open up a cafe. For me, I kind of stumbled into roasting. I loved roasting. I didn't know anything about running a cafe. I've worked a few barista shifts now, but there was a season where I worked some, but I've never been like spent an extensive amount of time on the bar. And so I didn't necessarily feel like I had a core competency in that area, and so my idea was I want to roast, and this is something I enjoy, and I'd love to, kind of work with somebody else that loves the whole cafe. Cafe. I mean, I loved the idea of cafes. I just didn't feel like I knew the business well enough to do it. But along the way, I took some classes. I asked a lot of questions. I learned, and we got to where we actually knew a decent amount about things. But I think the thing that really pushed me over the limit, we started out roasting for some other restaurants. And, for other people, some different offices and stuff like that. And along the way, being at Soda City, it goes from having maybe a couple hundred people show up on a Saturday to the market to thousands of people showing up. And every Saturday, I worked all of those markets, a lot of them just by myself at first. And then it was later had somebody else. And then I had two people with me, that kind of thing. And over and over and over, people ask, like, I look forward to this cup of coffee all week. Where can I get this Monday through Friday? And is there somewhere I can go get this? And after I heard that enough times, I probably heard that several thousand times, I started to say, I've heard this enough. I think there's actually a real demand and support for it. And I think it was actually our customers started to tell us they wanted us to open up a cafe. And I still had some trepidation because I was like, I just don't know what I don't know. And, so we took some classes, started reading everything I could get my hands on, trying to learn more about it. And then I guess, coupled with that, our wholesale business had grown some, and we were at the point where I had grown out of that detached garage. So, we had coffee bags stacked up the ceiling and cups and everything else to the point where I didn't really have room for any more growth there. And so we were kind of like, all right, I think we need, we need to start looking for a space somewhere else. So that was like in 2015, 2016, we kind of started that search. It took a while.
What made you end up saying, that this spot right here was the spot that you wanted?
Yeah. I mean, I lived on the side of town, and I drove past here all the time, and I mean, there was nothing on the side of town. No restaurants, no coffee shops, but there was a lot of, like, what I would say, like, you know, a lot of, you know, like, the residential part, I think there was a lot of really smart, creative, cool people that lived in these communities with zero amenities of the kind of stuff that people were interested in. I mean, other than there was a Burger King and a, you know, couple of, like, you know, fast food kind of places or whatever, and that's about it. And I mean, so as a consumer, I was like, look, I wish somebody would open up a coffee shop over here. You know, I wish somebody would open up a good sushi spot or a Thai restaurant and just driving by here. I mean, I was familiar with this area. This whole section in here was abandoned buildings. I mean, there was Sherwin-Williams Auto was over there. But other than that, this is just like kind of industrial wasteland. But I was looking for something downtown. We knew we couldn't afford a whole lot. And so I was like, you know, I was looking at lease rates in the Vista and, you know, that kind of thing. And I was like, this is crazy. But we liked the idea of being downtown. So, like, I started looking over here because I was like, you know, this is... And I was also looking at West Columbia some, too. But I was like, you know, this is, like, 13 blocks from the state capitol. But it's, you know, no parking meters. No, you know, it's like, you know, it's... You've got 277 and 126 converging, like, within a block or two of this area. And so there was, like, there wasn't any traffic on Sumter Street through here. I mean, this is twice a day you had, like, during rush hour, people would use this as a cut through to stay away from traffic. But other than that, nobody came over here. But we were like, I like, you know, I'm a sucker for old vintage buildings. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, stuff that has character. It's not cookie cutter. It's not. So I like the person. It had personality, it had grit. You know, it's and then it was kind of right up against. A lot of people had moved into these neighborhoods and these old historic houses, kind of renovated them and that kind of thing. So I think I liked that a lot. And that's what drew me. And so it was like, well, this is as close as we can get to downtown. And, like, we can get a good lease rate. And, you know, to be honest with you, I didn't expect that. I mean, I remember having a conversation with the president of one of the largest commercial real estate firms in Columbia. And he asked me, he said, so where's your coffee shop? You're looking to, you know, where are you looking to put in a coffee shop? And I was like, Sumter Street. And he said, Sumter Street? Well, I don't know, maybe. And, you know, you got the hospital over there, and he's talking about, like, Sumter Street over near, you know, Palmetto Baptist and, yeah, you know, like, kind of where the, what's the sound bites and cafe, the little crepes and croissants, and, you know, there's a couple little restaurants over there, Greek Boys, stuff like that. And I was like, no, not there. I'm talking about over, like, Cottontown on the other side of Elmwood. He was like, oh, I think you're in big trouble. He's like, nobody's going to go over there. That's a ghost town. And I was like, well, I've already signed a lease. I'm doing it, you know. But I mean, at the time I was like, we're going to have a roastery and we're going to deliver out of there and we'll have a small cafe, you know, we'll have a little bit of a cafe with it. But the more we got into this building, I was like, and we started peeling back layers, and I was like, yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff that was kind of covered up. We took all the drop ceilings out, and there's more and more personality kind of showing up in this building. And so we ended up making, it was going to be a large roastery and a small cafe. We ended up making it, you know, a large cafe with a small roastery. You know, keep in mind at the time, this 2017, so we'd had almost, like, basically 6.5 years of 7 years of Saturdays, the rain or shine, I was down there. and I got to know a lot of people. And I think a lot of people probably felt sorry for me and were rooting for the underdog, you know, because, and so when we did our grand opening on Tuesday night in May in 2017, the mayor's office told us we had, it kind of turned into a spontaneous block party. We had 1,100 people show up to our grand opening. We were expecting maybe 50 to 75. So it spilled out into the street, and this became this, like, somebody last week told me that this was one of the most memorable days in Columbia in the last 20 years was our grand opening. And so why did 1,100 people show up at our grand opening? We had to run out and get more beer like four times that day because we kept selling out. And people were just buying, like, all right, you're out of that. Okay, well, what else have we got? We'll take that, you know. And so I think it was a little bit of a, there's a lot of, like, even though there were no amenities on the commercial side, like the residential side, people had been buying fixer-uppers and fixing them up. They wanted to live close to downtown. So I think the timing actually worked out reasonably well with that.
Something I'm personally interested in is, when did you get the food truck that you use for Soda City?
Oh, boy. Is it 21 or 22? Hold on, I had to look here on my phone. Yeah, it was either, it was after COVID.
As someone who's relatively new to the Columbia area as it is, I was never able to know what it was like before that time. It's like the first time I actually set foot in Columbia was probably 2020, all things considered. Call me whatever you want. I'm not from here, even though I've grown to love it. But back to COVID-19. So you were operating the store from May of 2017 till, let's just say, March of 2020, and then COVID hit. What was that time frame in between March of 2020 and 2021 like?
So at the time, we had two cafes. We had this store, plus we'd opened up a store on Main Street. The store on Main Street, we was completely shut down.
When did you go from having the store here to having a place on Main?
Happened pretty fast. So we opened here and in 2017, and DR, who owns Circa Barbershop, you know, when I was looking at this spot, I knew he was looking for a second location, and this building was more space than we actually could handle. And so we were trying to find somebody to kind of like come in and take a little bit of the space so to kind of get the rent down a little bit. And so I asked, that new DR had, like, he was booked out like 12 weeks on men's haircuts on Main Street. And I'd actually talked with him about doing coffee shop beside his barbershop on Main Street before we were here. But it just never, like, the space didn't open up like we were hoping it would. And so he ended up coming here, and it worked really well to have them beside us. And a year later, he said, hey, Nick, this has been a really fun kind of symbiotic relationship. Would you want to do it again? And I was like, well, what do you have in mind? And he said, well, Main Street, you know, this spot. And so we ended up opening a small cafe there, which it was... Like, it was, it looked really nice, but I think it wasn't quite. We didn't have everything quite right about it. So it was a challenge at first. It was harder than we expected to be there.
And when did that location on Main?
That was 2018. Mm-hmm. And then that we opened it. But it actually had started really coming around and was doing pretty well. We were actually thinking, man, this is actually going to be a pretty good store in early 2020. And then just as we'd had four really good months consecutively, and we were like, all right, we finally got this figured out. We're getting some momentum. And then March of 2020 comes. And, you know, that was a very small store, and like all the offices, all that density, there were you know, probably 6,000-7,000 employees in the city block from us. They were all on furlough. Instead of coming downtown, they were staying home and working remote. So all of a sudden I went from being like having a lot of traffic to like zero traffic. And because it was a small store, we couldn't really distance safely there either. So we closed that store down completely. And it was closed for about, I think it was about 9 months straight, because it was just COVID and, you know. And during that time here, we went from having, I guess at the time we had about 17 employees. And we went from, you know, 17, 18 employees down to, it was just me, open to close. And I was the barista, this is janitor. I was the, like, roasting the coffee, like, come in every day. And it was like, I mean, it was crazy. And I was like, you know, this isn't sustainable. You know, I don't know how we're going to, but we did that for, you know, what we thought was going to be 3 weeks. You know, at first it was going to be like 1 to 2 weeks. Then it was 3 weeks. Then it was like a month. And then it was 3 months. And then, you know, I mean, it just kept like, is this ever going to end? But thankfully, we kind of weathered through that. I was, it's not going to lie, it was a really tough season. Started bringing our staff back after about 3 months, slowly.
Well, you survived COVID-19. You know, you made it out a lot better than a lot of other businesses, you know, all over the U.S. and the world for that matter. Like, do you feel lucky, or do you think that it was a lot of hard work, that a lot of time that you put in that helps?
I mean, all those things. I mean, I would use the word grateful.
Grateful.
More than lucky, you know, like, I mean, but, you know, I mean, like, certainly I think, you know, luck, you know, why one business, you know.
I have a bunch of regulars that kept you afloat during this time.
We did. I mean, for a while, at the time I had a little Toyota Prius, so I got like really good gas mileage. So I started doing free deliveries within a 2 mile radius. So I went from like being the only barista just here and making coffee and, you know, roasting coffee here, to then I started bringing back one person for half a day. And during that time, we'd do free deliveries. So we'd take the orders, because a lot of people weren't coming out. But if you would do a porch drop off, they loved getting, you know, coffee. So we did that for a while. And I mean, we just were just like anything we could do to kind of be productive as much as we could. And, yes, I mean, and a lot of people did, you know, buy whole bean coffee for their house during that time, that kind of thing. And I mean, yeah, it was devastating for a lot of small businesses.
Let's push all the COVID stuff, you know, in the past. I want to focus on the here and now. I got two more questions. One is, you as a small business owner, you have to source all of your stuff primarily. You have to do all of the logistics when it comes to sourcing your beans. It's like, you don't grow your own beans. Am I correct in saying that?
That is correct. Other than we do have a little bit of coffee cherry that grows in the window up front. But it's more of a
singular plant.
We don't produce coffee to that.
This is where my question comes in. Who do you buy your beans from? I've heard that you buy them from, this is small, primarily woman-owned growers.
Yeah, and that really goes back to the roots of, like, in my formative years of going to Origin, I saw that in a lot of cases, women were doing, you know, 80% of the work and getting 20% of the compensation. I'd see a lot of guys, like, taking naps out on the coffee sacks, and the women were working nonstop, but there weren't opportunities. And so very early on, that didn't, as a father of daughters, that didn't really sit well with me. And so as soon as I started becoming aware of, you know, there were a few cooperatives that were female owned, female produced, that kind of thing. And so I just started saying, well, you know what, if the coffee quality is there, I'm going to prioritize buying those over other coffees. And so, we started, kind of prioritizing those coffees. And so, like our Peru Las Damas San Ignacio, I mean, we've been buying that coffee for, I think this is our ninth year of buying that from that cooperative. And we keep it in stock pretty much all the time.
What countries do you buy coffee from?
All over the world. I mean, I guess you could say I'm origin agnostic, but in terms of if the coffee is good, I like trying coffees from all over the world. Cause it's like you get a little bit of a glimpse into like another culture and another way of things are a little different. I mean, oftentimes tell you what part of the world a coffee is from just by tasting it. Sometimes by smelling it. A coffee from, Rwanda or, Congo or Kenya, very different than a coffee from Ethiopia. It's very different from a coffee, coffees from Brazil or, Peru, like Central America have certain kind of general attributes. And I don't want to paint that too, like,
broad or too narrow.
Right, because there's also sometimes, in terms of Sumatra has a stereotypical profile that you would get from a Sumatra mandoling. And yet, we had a Sumatra, most Sumatra is processed, as I mentioned earlier, wet hold or Giling Besar. But there are a few cooperatives that are doing, anaerobic natural processing methods on Sumatras. And those coffees taste very different than the traditional processing method. And sometimes, even somebody that's like, I don't like Sumatra and coffee. And then I'm like, try this one. And then tell me what you think. Or don't tell them what it is. And, hey, how do you like this coffee? Oh, this is wonderful. Where's this from? Ethiopia? No, it's actually from Sumatra. What? So it's really interesting. Tasting coffees can give you clues I love coffees from all over the world. That said, I have my favorite origins. We probably always have a coffee from Peru, always have a coffee from Colombia, always have a coffee from Ethiopia. Generally, I'm probably going to have coffees from Central and South America, very approachable and delicious, but also like some of the coffees from Africa can be really exotic and unique and complex. And they reflect I'm going to butcher the word, but the terroir, kind of the context and the customs and the values and the culture, the history of a given place and space, it kind of tells a story. And so, I think I'm always open to that. And I mentioned earlier that I was drawn to community before I was drawn to the commodity or the actual product. And I think still I have cupped coffees in Indonesia and I've cupped coffees in Europe. I've cupped coffees in Medellin of, in different cities around the United States, but from people from all over the world. I mean, I have a friend in Malaysia that we met up on a trip and we were in, Colombia last year and we immediately hit it off just tasting coffees together and sharing experiences. And it just, I love how maybe more than any other product or commodity on the planet, it has a unique aspect that like kind of brings people together. It's a commonality, a point of relating to people who in many ways might be different, but then all of a sudden you're like, I've just met so many fascinating people over coffee.
Your business survived for one, and it seems to be thriving. Do you have any plans for the future that you think that people would be interested to know, or would you rather keep that close to your chest?
I mean, it's not really like any secrets. Small business in America is tough. The deck is stacked against small businesses. It can be exhausting over years. I talked to so many different restaurant owners, and when I say small business, service industry restaurants maybe are one of the tougher sectors. The failure rate on those is real, rather high. And over the people who do survive, I mean, it's a lot of times it's a lot of hours. But also, I mean, so most people do it, I think, more than just because of the money. They do it, because they love it or, have a passion. And so I think that has sustained me through some, COVID seasons. And, there's some, even now, I think there's some economic headwinds. Price of coffee from September of last year to this year is 56% higher than the price was last year. But, my margins haven't grown in step with that. So it's kind of getting squeezed on some things. So, I mean, there's always challenges, and that's the thing. Entrepreneurs have to figure that out, and it's and then in terms of, staffing has been really challenging really since COVID. But in terms of plans, I think I'm always open to, looking for the right opportunity, but I'm also temper that with, I have opened a second cafe and, an external factor, COVID caused it to be shut down for almost a full year there. And then it was like I almost had to start from scratch again to rebuild it. And even when it did, if that shop was there now, it might work again, but it's taken probably 3.5 years for people to come back to the office space there. So there's so many things like that. So I think I temper that with there's part of me that loves the idea of something new, opening something, but I'm also, and so even doing the food truck was kind of a way to a little bit lower risk kind of way to jump into having another location without a full on build out. Construction costs are crazy right now. Lease rates are incredibly expensive. So it's very capital intensive. And so I think right now I'm kind of more of a let's wait and see if things change where they're maybe a little more favorable or I find the right opportunity. Yeah, I mean, I'd be very open to doing another location. Sorry, that was a ramble.
You answered everything that I had.
Yeah.
This time you went on quite a lot longer than I had expected to, but
there's so much to say. It's like, where do I even begin? But yeah.
Thank you for listening to The Small and Local. This episode is From Roast to Host and is covered into coffee from Columbia, South Carolina. Thank you for listening to this week's episode, and I hope you enjoyed the interview that I had the pleasure of doing with Nick Hooser. This episode of The Small and Local was edited and produced by Jarrett Wright. A special thanks goes out to Nick Hooser for giving his time to be interviewed. Intro and outro music is Sunset in the City by Andrew Jeremy, used under the Attribution Non-Commercial Creative Commons license. If you're interested in any future projects, I would greatly appreciate it if you followed for more episodes. And to see what else I'm working on currently, please check my Linktree. Thanks for tuning in.